Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday afternoon. Thanks so much for being here with us. I should say hello to the people for whom it is Saturday morning, like our friend James over in the Philippines as well, and everybody on the other side of the dateline. Good morning to you. Thank you for being here with us. The number here is 888-318-7884. If you are on the other side of the dateline, you're going to have to use the international calling code to get in. But 888-318-7884. Trent Horn is our guest this hour. Dr. Stacy Trusenkos next hour. Of course, when Dr. Stacy's here, we do faith and science. So if you've got faith and science questions, be sure to call in that hour. This hour, tips for defending the faith. You want to defend God? I mean, God's under attack in lots of places. You want to defend Jesus, the Bible, the teachings of the church? Well, that's what Trent Horn does, and he does it very well. So you are welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. Trent's got a new book. It's called Confusion in the Kingdom, How Progressive Catholicism is Bringing Harm and Scandal to the Church. You can get it on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. Trent Horn, welcome.
Howdy, Si. I when you said Dr. Stacy's going to be on, I was thinking there's an episode of The Simpsons where they go to Broadway and they see Troy McClure in a musical adaptation of Planet of the Apes called Stop Planet of the Apes, I Want to Get Off. And there is a song where with one of the, they're saying, Dr. Zaius, do do do. So you guys should take AI and take that, but make it Dr. Stacy, do 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 do. That could be your introduction. Whip that up. You guys have it ready by next hour.
We're kind of not using AI at the moment, so.
Why did I miss something? I've been in Micronesia for 2 weeks.
Right. 888-318. Doesn't matter if you're in Micronesia. You would have heard about it. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. If you would like tips for defending the faith, you're welcome to call. And part of the reason why I say, you know, we want to defend God, you want to defend Jesus, because we certainly have fellow Christians who might want to defend some aspect of the life of the church, even if you don't share our ecclesiology. That is, even if your idea of what and where the church is not the same as ours. But you'd like some help talking about Jesus with other people or talking about the Bible or the Trinity, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We'll start in Orange County today, just up the road from us. Dana is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Oh, I know. Dana, Orange County, we always make the same joke. Do you know what it is when we have Trent, when we have Dana?
I do not.
Dana Point. Dana, oh, yeah. What's your point?
It's a beautiful place.
Because Dana Point is in Orange County.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Dana, go ahead with your point.
Okay, so I have full disclosure. I had to con my way through the screener because he said my whole deal here was not consistent with the show. But to defend myself, the show really wasn't announced until just a little while ago. I just saw it was Trent Horn. Anyway, listen, you put out the Bigfoot video on your very successful Council of Trent podcast, and I agree that, you know, using Bigfoot as a way to criticize the New Testament is really just a canard. But I also really strongly disagreed with some of your comments that the apostles were not benefiting by spreading the gospel. I think they were benefiting in significant ways. Most notably, they had people lining the streets with just the hopes that Peter might, you know, touch them with his shadow. That sounds very celebrity-like to me. There's a scene in Acts about a Roman centurion, Cornelius, bowing down in reverence publicly at Peter's feet and the apostles' feet. Mm-hmm. And then there's other scenes of them, you know, having people come up to them and lay money at their feet. And if we're to believe what Paul is writing in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, they have a right to keep some of that money that's being laid at their feet. Those who serve at the altar should share what is given at the altar. You know, those who preach the gospel should make their living from the gospel. So you have them being treated as celebrities.
All right, Dan.
And they're making money doing this.
Trent?
Yeah, so my point was with the comparisons in that video saying, oh, well, people who claim to have seen the risen Jesus, it's just like people who claim to see Bigfoot. They're just both cases of mass delusions, and I show in the episode that there's important, they're disanalogous. There are important differences between the two cases. And one of the differences I highlighted was that there was a significant... there were gains to claiming you saw Bigfoot, but also not really any costs. That if you say I saw Bigfoot out there, you get to be on the news and like it's fun, and nobody is gonna like pelt you to death with rocks for saying that you saw Bigfoot. So I think a lot of the people who claim to have seen Bigfoot the question here about the apostles, whether they gained something, a lot of it deals with their sincerity. Like a hypothesis, not a lot of people really defend, but some do, is that, well, they could have just made it up to, you get a lavish lifestyle, you're celebrities, yada, yada. I think, though, that this is, most people agree that they were very sincere in their beliefs. Even with the Bigfoot cases, there might be some people who are faking it because they want the attention. That's highly plausible. I think a lot of the Bigfoot cases, it's a case of mistaken identity. You see something not very well, and you think it's Bigfoot because there's a Bigfoot hysteria going on at the moment, which I don't think certainly wouldn't apply really in the case of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. But like with the Bigfoot cases, yeah, you get some celebrity and not really any costs. I think it's a bit anachronistic to think that the disciples in first century Judea would value something like celebrity in the same way that we value it today. It's a radically different culture. There really weren't celebrities. There were just the poor, the rich who oppressed them, and the rich rulers who oppressed and could get you killed. There weren't really the closest to celebrities would be being like a healing wonder worker, like what Jesus was doing. And so, but I don't think they would have really sought that out, because even if there's some gain of like, adulation, the negative costs involved would really outweigh it unless you really sincerely believe in this. Now, I do think that there are some people you can tell that they're insincere in claiming to be a Messiah or some founder of a new religion, in that it's very convenient they do things like have multiple underage wives, or they acquire a large amount of money to live lavishly. We really have no evidence that the apostles did that. With even the money that they had, that they tend to allocate that for the good of the church as a whole, like by redirecting it to help for a famine in Judea or something like that. So even if there was some marginal gain, I would say their lives were more comfortable prior to going out and being an apostle of Jesus Christ, and to undertake the severe discomforts involved, as Paul talks about, with shipwrecks and stonings and all these other terrible things happening. Sincerity is the best explanation for why they would risk so much discomfort that easily outweighs any marginal comforts that might be present. But thank you, Dana, so much for the question. I always enjoy when you call in. Definitely enjoy to hear from you again. So thanks a lot.
All right. But to the other beach on the other side of the country, we go to Myrtle Beach. Robert is in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, watching on YouTube. Robert, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Oh, great. Well, it's a real pleasure to speak to you, Trent. I've been watching your videos on YouTube for a long time now, and I wanted to thank you and let you know that your videos have been instrumental in helping me come to faith, to believe in Christianity, to know that God is real. So I just wanted to let you know, thank you for that.
Praise
you
to God.
You are making a difference. Yes. And I wanted to ask you specifically if you had any advice for me. Since I've come to faith and I've decided to become a Christian, I'm wrestling with how to broach this with my family. My family's Jewish, and they're not going to be pleased with my decision. In fact, I think they're really going to be hurt, especially my mother and my grandmother. So any advice you have, or anything that you could help me say to them to help them understand my decision, I'd really appreciate it.
What kind of, are they Orthodox or conservative, or
they're Orthodox.
Oh, wow.
Orthodox.
Yeah, that is...
I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. They're not Orthodox. They're conservative.
Even still, I mean, it's not like they're... Because if they're like Reformed Jews, it's like, whatever. I mean, that's the most liberal...
They're not Reformed, but their faith is very important to them.
Exactly, yeah. So it's not just... you know what is funny? Even among people that are more conservative and Reformed, what can be difficult, even among more conservative and Orthodox, I find that there are many Jews that would be more open to you becoming an atheist than becoming a Christian. I don't know if that's something.
I was going to say that, like, that's definitely the case.
Yeah, it is. It is, because because there is a difficulty there in that there is a history of the relationship between Jews and Christians since the time of the apostles, of a difficult relationship there that's often been hampered by anti-Semitism. Also, it's been hampered by some Jewish texts, and Jewish individuals have expressed hatred towards Christianity, and there have been Christian individuals who have expressed hatred or malice towards Jewish people and have harmed Jewish people in various ways. And that's something that Catholics have to reckon with. But I think if you're going to tell your family this, I think what can be helpful is to just say, you know, I really do respect you all. I respect the Jewish foundation of the Catholic faith. And really, as a faithful Jew, I am looking for a Messiah. And to see, especially to say, look, when you, and there's a lot of proof texts people argue about, I like to look at Isaiah 11 that talks about how in the reign of the Messiah, the knowledge of God will be as plentiful. I think it's like as plentiful as the waters on the face of the earth or from sea to sea. There, the knowledge of God will spread throughout the whole world. And I can't imagine anyone else who could fill that candidacy of having brought the knowledge of God to so many people besides Jesus Christ, that before Jesus, knowledge of the true God, which would have been the Jews, was just a tiny fraction of humanity. But when you look at, but now since then, half of the world, a third of the world professes Christianity or Judaism, half professes belief in a monotheistic God. So I think we can really, and you know, that's really attributed because Islam is really an offshoot of Christianity, and some people even call it a Christian heresy, frankly. To see that Christ really fulfills this and has brought the fulfillment of Judaism. So I think things you can introduce them to. I love Brant Petrie's work, The Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, The Jewish Roots of Mary. Roy Schumann has a great book, Salvation is from the Jews. To tell them that by choosing to be Christian, choosing to be Catholic, you do not have malice or antipathy towards Judaism. It's something that you can, you know, cherish still with them, but you're just seeking that fulfillment. And I think you might find in sharing the Catholic faith with them, there are a lot of similarities between Catholic worship and liturgy and Jewish worship at Shabbat. So I would just recommend diving deep in a lot of these sources, Schumann, Petrie, to see how Judaism finds its fulfillment of Catholicism, being that example, and then taking heart that if they give you a hard time, this is the very first thing that Christians dealt with in the first century. They dealt with being thrown out of the synagogue. They dealt with persecution. And just to know that you are in the company of the earliest saints for this particular kind of accusations of betrayal. And I remember once I was staying with a host family, and they, the dad, he was Jewish, and he found out my father's Jewish, but I'm Catholic. And I said, I'll get you some books on Catholicism. He said, I'm going to get you books on Judaism, you little turncoat. He was joking, but half joking. But I mean, these are things just to draw close to God, draw close to his Jewish mother. Always nice to have a Jewish mother to take care of you, and just to enter deeply into that. So that would be a start. Is that helpful, Rob?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
All right, no problem.
Oh, God bless you, Rob. Thank you very much for the call. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is our guest, and it's tips for defending the faith. If you've got questions about how to defend any aspect of the faith, you are welcome to call. Since it's Friday and you have the weekend to think about it, I think I'll invite you again to come on our Catholic Answers cruise June 29th through July 6th. I heard that we're within five of the maximum we can possibly do. So that's pretty good. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. June 29th through July 6th, we start in Montreal and we work our way up and around the St. Lawrence Seaway. We'll visit Quebec, Nova Scotia, some other places. And then in the United States, we'll visit Bar Harbor, Maine, and Boston. And we'll have a lot of fun and lots of great guests with us. And if you want to check out the whole thing and see if it's something you want to do with us, just go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com. We're going to be doing the flannel panel on the ship, Chris Check, Joe Heschmeyer, and myself. But there's just all kinds of great stuff going to happen. CatholicAnswersCruise.com. We are going now to Tom in New Jersey, watching on YouTube. Tom, I could be mistaken about this, but I feel like when Trent's on, we usually get a call from you.
I don't, not always.
Oh, okay.
The last time I called was a few months ago.
Oh, well, you must just make a good impression, because I do remember you. But I'm glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
A return customer, always fun.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I read second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. It's mostly good. I want to turn to chapter 29, Advanced Bodily Rights Objections.
Will you just read the whole chapter for our listeners? They're going to want to hear the whole chapter. Go ahead, Tom. Start.
Yeah. You talk about your debate with David Boonin, and you mention how your argument is, well, the reason a woman should be legally required to provide uterine support to her child, but why Shimp should not be legally forced to provide bone marrow support to his cousin is because, well, a uterus is for keeping an unborn child alive, but your bone marrow is not for keeping your cousin alive. So you say that's the reason why it should be illegal in one case, but legal in the other case. Okay, so Boonin replies to that, okay, well, if that's true, if your rationale is the law should force you to use your organs for whatever they are for, then logically, a man should be legally prohibited from using his organs for purposes that they're not designed for, i.e. engaging in non-procreative sex. All right, mm-hmm. We didn't evolve penises in order to engage in non-procreative sex. And you respond in your book, well, the reason is because when you have an abortion or when you masturbate in public as opposed to in private, in those cases you are harming other people, and you say those should be illegal. But then
Tom, I gotta move you towards a question, because it's taking
I think I see a little bit what you're saying, that if it's then the harm principle, like if you don't give your bone marrow to, was it Shemp? I always confuse them with the Three Stooges, the names of people in that case. So it's like Shemp, Hurley.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's you're harming him as well. Though honestly, I'm a little bit, I have a few thoughts on that. So, and you're right. And maybe I might just tweak that a little bit to make my point a little bit clearer. But I would say first, if you don't give your bone marrow to your cousin who's dying and they need bone marrow to live, I don't think you really harm them, because harm means you make someone worse off than they were previously. And I would say you're not really harming them, because you're not making them worse off. You're just failing to make them better off. But abortion, just, it's a lot different. Like, abortion really, I would say, makes the fetus fairly worse off. So I think that's a little bit different in the case. I also think it's helpful, like, the idea here about the duties we have to allow other people to use our organs. It might be helpful to reframe it into what rights to things do people have? And normally we don't, we take the teleology of the body into account to say, no one has a natural right to organs, you know, to bone marrow in another person's body. But, and this is my big thing with Boonin and others, that the argument trying to say, look, a fetus could be a person with a right to life, but, and Boone kind of makes this, answers this objection a little, but I don't think successfully. It would be this. If you're saying that the fetus has a right to life, but it does not have a right to reside in the uterus, it doesn't have a right to the mother's body, it seems like when we say it has a right to life, that it has no meaning to it. Because the right to life for a fetus without the right to the one thing that lets the fetus, the unborn child, live, it just seems like it's just an empty set of words. It's not really a right at all. But to say that, like, Shemp has a right to life, that's a very rich and meaningful phrase that does not obviously have and almost certainly does not contain the right to bone marrow in another person's body. So I think maybe if we looked at it in the other direction of when do people have the right to other people's bodies, that the unborn child's right to the uterus is much similar to a newborn infant's right to nursing breasts if that's the only thing that can sustain him or her. So that might be the way I would look at it. So maybe I'll tweak a little bit of that, although I thought I made that point a little bit in the book. So that might be how I would take a look at that. Tom, what do you think of that?
Okay, well, regarding the breast milk thing, I've actually asked that to many people and who are pro-choice, and they've said, no, if the only way a baby can be kept alive is by being breastfed by their mother, no, the mother should not be legally forced to breastfeed the baby. That's actually what they've said.
Yeah, and I think I would say that's an example of biting the bullet. That we do have to understand that when we engage in ethical reasoning with people, especially like what is right or what is wrong, a lot of times it goes down this route. Well, X is wrong because if you say X is right, then Y would be right, but Y is clearly wrong. So X must be wrong. And some people will say, maybe Y just did. Maybe it's not wrong. I mean, in theory, what if you have a small community that says, hey, none of the women here want to breastfeed this child. They're just not interested. Maybe it's got a face that not even a mother can love. And can they all just collectively decide to let that child starve to death? I would say that that's absolutely barbaric if that were the case, that human beings are not isolated, atomized individuals. We have our right to life exists because of corresponding moral duties we have to one another, and there are greater moral duties parents have to their children. You might not have to donate your kidney to your kid, but I would say that infants and unborn children have a natural right to the organs whose purpose is clearly to keep them alive. Like bone marrow, the only way bone marrow could keep someone else alive is because of medical technology that's been invented. There's no natural connection to someone dying of kidney failure in another person's bone marrow, but there certainly is a natural connection between infants and unborn children and the bodies of their mothers. And I would say that gives you much firmer ground to establish a natural right to those organs, and therefore the moral and legal impermissibility of killing children via abortion. But Tom, thanks for the intellectually stimulating discourse.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Rob is watching on YouTube in Green Bay. Welcome, Rob. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you. I just picked up your book at the Cathedral Book and Gift here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, just an hour ago. So The Confusion in the Kingdom, I'm about to read that.
Oh, cool.
So thank you for that.
Yeah.
My question revolves around translations of the Old Testament and what we use in modern day Catholic Bibles in our efforts to use apologetic means to try and convert some of our Protestant brethren.
Right.
What I understand is, like from the dialogue with Trifo with Justin Martyr, he's warning against them changing some of the things in the Old Testament to be less Christological as the Messiah. The Virgin in Isaiah 7:14. And my question is, why are so many modern Catholic translations relying on the Masoretic text that was done, in the 900s versus using the Septuagint, which was done in 250 BC and was actually quoted more often in the New Testament? And also it included the Deuterocanonical books so that we, if we draw that connection and show that to our Protestant brethren, then they would begin to see the importance of many of the dogma of the Catholic Church that are in the Deuterocanonical, and they see the typological connections between the old and the new and how sound our doctrine is.
Well, we do use the Septuagint text, especially for deuterocanonical works that only exist in Greek. Biblical scholars will use a variety of manuscripts to base their translations on. And while the Masoretic text, the complete copies come from the Middle Ages, we do have good textual criticism to push it back further, especially with the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I'll put a bow on this when we come back.
All right. If you would, Rob, just hang on a quick second and we'll get a chance to finish that answer. It's Tips for Defending the Faith. Trent Horn is our guest. 888-318-7884 is the number.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, book cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whyweearecatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Are you scared to talk about abortion? Don't worry, almost everyone is. You can overcome this fear, as Trent Horn shows in the newly revised and expanded second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. With a little knowledge and a few proven techniques, you can become a bold and effective apologist for life. Visit shop.catholic.com to order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life and never again be afraid to speak up. Also available at good Catholic bookstores. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is our guest. His new book, already recommended by one listener, and another listener said he can't wait to get reading it. He just bought it. Confusion in the Kingdom, How Progressive Catholicism is Bringing Harm and Scandal to the Church. Get it. That one fellow said he got it at the bookstore. Lots of people are getting it over at shop.catholic.com, our website. Check it out there. Right now we have Rob on the line with a question about why translators use the Masoretic texts rather than the Septuagint, and you were in the midst of an answer, Trent.
Yeah, so what I said was that translators do use the Septuagint for works, obviously, that were not originally written in Hebrew, for example. But there's always going to be a bit of a gap. Even, you know, the Septuagint was written a few centuries before the time of Christ, but our earliest manuscripts, complete manuscripts of it, come several centuries later. A much longer gap for the Masoretic text, but scholars who engage in textual criticism have been able to compare the older Masoretic text to things that are found, for example, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, to show that it's still very accurate. So what scholars would do, they usually will try to go with something that has the older pedigree, which would be the Hebrew Masoretic text, that would, you know, go back further than the Septuagint, even though the oldest complete copies are later in the AD period. So they might base it on that, but they'll still include other checks like the Septuagint or the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Targums, which are the summaries of the texts that were made in paraphrases made in Aramaic, that'll be cross-referenced with each other. And a lot of the differences there, it doesn't mean that it's a radical change of the text. So Rob mentioned in Isaiah 7:14, "Behold, a virgin shall give birth." In the Hebrew, it's Alma. In the Septuagint, it's Parthenos, which is more of an actual virgin, whereas Alma would mean young woman. But still, it's referring to something that's of a special miraculous nature here. And nearly all Alma's young maiden, Alma, it would best be translated like maiden. And most maidens are maidens really are virgins. It's, they're identified as different than matrons or women or things like that. So I don't think that it's problematic there. The textual scholar is just trying to be faithful to reconstruct the original text as much as possible. And different books, they'll use different resources to be able to do that. I definitely recommend John Bergsma. And I think Brant Petrie have a great book called The Catholic Introduction to the Old Testament, very thick book that covers a lot of the elements of the Old Testament that I would definitely recommend for you or anyone else who wants a deep dive into Old Testament scholarship. But thank you so much for calling in, Rob.
Thank you, Rob. Let us continue on. It's Tips for Defending the Faith this hour with Trent Horn, and Lewis is in Southwest Missouri watching on YouTube. Lewis, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
So I'm a recent revert to the Catholic Church, and I have like a real zeal for the church now. I'm reading as much as I can and going to Mass daily and all that. And I live in the Bible Belt, and there's a lot of people that I work with that are just nominal Christians. They don't like dogma, they don't like doctrine, they just, I guess the word you could say is domesticated Christ.
Okay.
And they believe in their Christ, but anytime I try to bring up the truths of the Catholic Church, they squash it away. And I guess my question is, how can I get them to, like, start looking into it? Because they seem like they just don't care. And they're good people. I love them to death, yeah. But they just don't seem to care.
Yeah, no, I understand. That's difficult. Part of that, I mean, probably the toughest questions I have to confront are questions related to apathy. You know, how do you get people to care? If someone says, well, it doesn't matter, as long as you believe in Jesus, it's okay. You can point to them the words of Jesus, who said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Well, what are Jesus's commandments? So you can always invite them maybe to a Catholic Bible study or a talk at your parish on like Jesus and the sacraments. I like pointing people to say, well, look, what did Jesus say about himself? Take and eat. This is my body. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life within you. He gives power and authority to the apostles to forgive sins. He established a church. All right, well, if Jesus gave us a church, he refers to it as the church, his church, not a million churches. Which one am I supposed to belong to? You know, they're teaching different doctrines. I'm supposed to submit to the authority of the leaders of that church. The letter to the Hebrews says to submit to the elders who have authority over you. Well, who should I choose in that regard? I would just challenge him to say, you know, you say you believe in Jesus, but how many of Jesus' teachings are you following? And it's not just Jesus. What about the apostles he called? What about everything else we see in the New Testament? So I think that really pointing them towards like the obligation that we have, like especially receiving Jesus in the Eucharist, Jesus gave the apostles the ability to forgive sins. And just really bring it back to, should we find the church that Jesus established? And they might say, well, the church is just everybody who believes in Jesus. You might say, well, how is that a church? What can that church do? Can it correct me? Well, no, because you Christians might think what I'm doing is fine. Another Christian might say, oh, it's bad doctrine, it's good doctrine. I think maybe pointing people towards that to shake them from their complacency and ask them, look, you agree. There's people who say they believe in Jesus, like Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, but you would say that they don't because they get Jesus's nature wrong. Well, what about people who get Jesus's church wrong or salvation wrong or think you can't lose your salvation? If they're also in error, what do you do there? We're supposed to follow everything that Jesus teaches. So that might be where I would start. Lewis, I'd also like to help you on your quest here. I'd like you to stay on the line. I'd love to send you two copies of my book, Why We're Catholic, one for you and maybe one to give out to a friend you're having a conversation with to keep the dialogue going. So is that helpful?
Yeah, it's real helpful. In fact, I've kind of gone into that with another coworker where I said, you know, Jesus founded a church and that's the Catholic Church. And his argument was, well, what about the Crusades?
Yeah, I'd say, what about them? You could say here, okay, I would say to him, look, does the church exist? If Jesus gave us a church, is it still here? If it's not here, That would violate Jesus's teaching when he said the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. If it is here, he's got to find it somewhere. If he says, well, it's just all Christians, you say, well, haven't all Christians done terrible things at some point? Can't you blame the body of Christ for stuff? But that doesn't mean Christ's church ceased to exist because some Christians have done bad things. And you can also then get into, we have resources for that on our website, catholic.com, saying that while there were abuses during the Crusades, you might say to him, well, isn't it a good thing to for the church to rescue Christians in the Holy Land who were being subjugated by Muslim conquerors, who, if they were not removed, we would not have access to the Holy Land anymore. One of the saddest things for me, when I go to the Holy Land, the site of Christ's ascension into heaven is not owned, it's not controlled by any Christian church. Different churches have different control over the different holy sites, or, you know, Israel has control over them. But the ascension, that site is controlled by a Muslim trust. The Waqf, I think is what it's called. And you can visit it, but there's no sacred images, and you're not. And at least what I was told at the time when I was there, you're not allowed to celebrate Mass. And so it's just very sad to not be able to fully embrace this this aspect of our faith, to go to the site where Christ ascended into heaven, and not be able to fully live it out because a non-Christian group controls it. And when Christians should be able to have control over this sacred heritage, this sacred history put into real places, you know, for us, that we should be able to retain that as a part of our heritage. And that was an essential element of the Crusades, even though there were abuses along the way for some people, you know, just out for glory or, you know, money or things like that. But yeah, definitely check out Steve Weidenkopf. Has a great book called The Glory of the Crusades. You can also find great articles on it on that on our website at Catholic.com.
I'll tell you what, let's send him The Glory of the Crusades.
Let's send it to him.
So, and you get a copy, and you get a copy. Hang on, we'll send you a copy of The Glory of the Crusades. But thank you for the call. I'm going to just keep moving, try to get as many on as I can with Trent while we've got him. Second hour is a faith and science hour. Dr. Stacey Trusenko's scientist and theologian, will be here with us. Jeannie's in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on Catholic.com. Jeannie, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi there.
Hi.
So the call screener and I had a little trouble defining my question, so please bear with me. As I understand, according to Acts 2, repenting and getting baptized results in the forgiveness of our sins and the reception of the Holy Spirit. I actually have Protestant friends who do believe that, believe that baptism is necessary for salvation. But then, you know, obviously, okay, just to clarify, you know, so like according to Acts 2, the forgiveness of sins, well, I guess we would more so say the forgiveness of sins and gift of the Holy Spirit, like that we receive at the sacrament of baptism, are saving graces. However, according to my understanding of mortal sin, this is where, you know, Catholicism differs from my Protestant friends. A repentant, baptized Christian committing a mortal sin results in the death or loss of both these graces within us, which is why we go to hell if we die in that state. Confession is the sacrament that gives us these graces again. My question is, theologically, why is baptism required if confession gives the same graces? Is there a salvific grace-based difference between an unbaptized person and a baptized person with the stain of mortal sin?
Yes, there is a difference. So baptism causes an ontological change in the soul. It leaves an indelible mark. So it's actually one of three sacraments that do that, the others being the sacrament of confirmation and the sacrament of holy orders. So baptism remits all punishment for sin and communicates the forgiveness of all sins, so any personal sin committed, as well as the stain of original sin. And that's not something that is communicated through the sacrament of confession. So the sacrament of baptism is necessary to make us part of God's family, to make us adopted children of God. And so that causes a change within our souls. It leaves that indelible mark, so that even if we apostatize and forever reject the faith, we do not return, our souls do not return to the state that they were in prior to baptism. But those actions do cause a loss of charity or of God's love in the soul, the death of charity in the soul, and that causes the loss of sanctifying grace. So the sacrament of confession restores us to friendship with God, whereas the sacrament of baptism is what makes us children of God. And so baptism only happens once because of that. Nothing changes that. We might be forsaken children, prodigal children. We might be children who have permanently rejected God, but baptism only happens once. It cannot be repeated. Confession, however, deals with something that can change, which is that sanctifying grace God gives us, the friendship we have with God. That can be lost if we turn away from God through a sin that is great, that is grave, fully known, and freely chosen. And so that is why confession is necessary to restore the sanctifying grace, to restore charity in the soul that is killed through mortal sin. But it does not change the soul in the same way that baptism had. So they're different in that respect. Is that helpful?
Yes, it is helpful. Am I allowed to ask a
quick Sure, please go ahead, Jean.
Yeah, sure.
So I guess from a pastoral perspective, I think the big problem that a lot of my friends have with this is like they can't imagine living this way in a relationship with God, where it's like, how, you know, I feel like it's not unreasonable to think that like every day or every other day at the very least, like a person's going to commit an intentional sin. And, you know, I know that it's a little hard to distinguish, like, intentional sin a mortal sin?
No, because that's just a part of it. So just because you intentionally do something, like if you intentionally, I'll go to Sprouts and I get like the dark chocolate covered cashews. They're wonderful. And I fill up my bag and I intentionally take one extra dark chocolate almond and I eat it and I don't pay for it. That is the intentional sin of theft. Is it a mortal sin? No. Is it a venial sin that blemished my soul? Hey, it starts with stealing almonds and next for stealing Cadillacs. You can progress. But like that particular act, like venial sins are intentional. Or if you say, you know, a white lie, you might be in a situation like, this is awkward. I don't want to be here. And you tell a little white lie to get out of it. Well, that can, venial sins can start to add up. They blemish the soul and make us more inclined to maybe tell a really, really bad lie, or to, you know, hey, I found this wallet on the ground. It's got $200 in it. I could turn it back in, but no one's going to miss it. So mortal sin, it's not just that you intend to do it. It has to be a grave matter. It has to be something that's serious matter that is involved. And you're fully aware that it's serious and you fully intend it. So mortal sins are not something that people commit every other day. But I think you can say to your Protestant friends, look, you believe the same thing that we do. Like your Protestant friends would say, look, can someone be a Christian? You wouldn't say, oh, that guy told, you know, he tells white lies and he takes an extra dark chocolate cashew at Sprouts. You know, he's not a real Christian. He's not in our church. People would say, well, you know, everybody makes mistakes, but God loves us. But if that same guy was an abortionist, or if that woman was an OnlyFans pornographer, we treat that, you know, we treat that differently. We treat, you know, if a guy was going around stealing money from the homeless every day, that's different than stealing an extra dark chocolate cashew. Your friends, I think they would recognize that there are sins that are the minor sins that a Christian can commit. You're still a Christian, but there are major sins. If they kept doing this, some of them would say, oh, he was never saved in the first place. He's not a real Christian. So even they would recognize, yeah, there are minor and major sins. Nearly all Protestants recognize that. So you could say, look, then what do you do? Let's say, you know, you're in your Protestant Bible study, your church, you know, let's say you're a husband, you commit a minor sin, like you look too long at another woman. Is that a mortal sin? No, but you know, you lost custody of the eyes a bit. But let's say that same married man, he commits the act of adultery. Now you might say, look, what does that guy do? They'd probably say he should probably, like, would he ask God for forgiveness? I'm sure he would have this deep innate desire to say, God, I am so sorry I did that. In the sense that if he didn't do that, it would mean that he like turned away from God. Because otherwise, if they said, well, you know, Jesus died for all of our sins, past, present, and future. Like if that really were true, why ask for forgiveness? It would be like if we had a cafeteria, Catholic Answers, we don't. We have a little break room, but it's still fun. But if we had a cafeteria and Cy Kellett paid for all my meals for the year, and every day I was like, hey, Cy, can I have money for this meal? Cy, can I have money for this meal? Hey, Cy, can I have money for this meal? He'd be like, dude, I already paid for all the meals, man. Stop asking. So if Jesus like paid for all of our sins, past, present, and future, please forgive me, Lord, please forgive me. Well, I already paid for them. Why even bother? But deep down, we know it's good when we sin to ask for forgiveness, that either we've damaged our relationship with God and we ask for our souls to be repaired when they're blemished, aka venial sin, or we ask God to we humbly return to him like the prodigal son did. I am dead in sin now. I've lost sanctifying grace. All I have now is the little actual grace you gave me to come back to you in humility and seeking you in mercy. I am sorrowful for sin because I've offended thee. Please forgive me, Lord. I would say that deep down, Protestants really do believe the same thing about sin and reconciliation. They just don't have the sacraments, the things Christ gave us, to have it all be sensible and in accord with Scripture, because Jesus told the apostles in John 20:23, whose sins you forgive are forgiven, whose sins you retain are retained. So that would be a start. Jeannie, would you like any other clarification?
No, that was awesome. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you, Jeannie. Yeah, I don't know why. I'm really hungry after that whole exchange. I'm extremely hungry, but thank you, Jeannie. It's good talking with you. We've got to take a quick break. Yep. Right back with more tips for defending the faith.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
EWTN Global Catholic Network is the largest religious media network in the world. 11 global TV channels, English and Spanish radio networks with over 500 AM and FM radio affiliates, one of the largest Catholic websites in the world, dozens of podcasts every week, social media, electronic and print news services, and EWTN publishing. EWTN is the global Catholic network. For more about EWTN, visit EWTN.com.
Tips for defending the faith this hour with Trent Horn. Next hour, Faith and Science with Dr. Stacy Trusenko, scientist and theologian, both of them in Texas. Our whole show, it's Texas-based today. You're welcome to call if you've got a question about defending the faith. We're going to go to Jen in Virginia, watching on YouTube. Jen, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my question is something I read in my school. Well, we have this thing called read theory, and we answer the questions. But there's one question where it was kind of biased towards the promotion of euthanasia. So I want to. So the author argues on it, or gives an argument. So I want your thoughts on it. So I put the argument in a syllogism form. So, to make it easier,
okay, sure. Go ahead.
One says euthanasia decreases suffering by providing a humane option to end intolerable physical and psychological pain for terminally ill patients. And premise two says euthanasia respects the rights of the patient, so it should be allowed. What do you think?
Well, I would say that that's not an argument, actually, because the premises don't build on one another. Those are really just two separate claims. It's the claim that euthanasia should be permitted because it respects the choice of the patient. Euthanasia should be permitted because it decreases suffering. That seems to be the two elements there. That's not an argument per se. It's really just more reasons that are given. Would say, well, then the argument would be implicitly assuming that it's always good to respect the wishes of a patient, or it's always good to decrease suffering. So to refute that argument, all you'd have to do is just show counterexamples to show, actually, we don't always accede to the requests of a patient, or we don't always decrease suffering. So for example, you could have a patient, let's say someone who is paralyzed from the waist down in an accident. They're paralyzed from the waist down, and they say, you know, I don't want to live like this anymore. I suffer. I'm in pain. You know, maybe they're not in pain. They could have some phantom limb pain, But they'd say, I'm suffering a lot in having to be in a wheelchair. I don't want to live anymore. I want to die. But most mm-hmm. people would say, well, no, we're not going to help you kill yourself. We do that. What I find is helpful with the question of euthanasia and assisted suicide is to point out that we agree there are cases of suicide where we don't let people commit suicide. We would say, no, your life is valuable. You don't have a right to end your own life. There is no autonomy there. We have to respect. But even if something decreased suffering, like if you say, well, it decreases suffering, so it's good. Why not go into nursing homes and kill all kinds of people go to cancer wards, kill people who are dying there? Say, well, no, they didn't choose to it. Oh, okay. So decreasing suffering can't be what makes killing good, because killing can be bad, even if it decreases suffering. Instead, you could point out, look, there are some people who try to commit suicide, and we say, no, that's not a good reason. Okay. You know, just because you're depressed, for example, no, you shouldn't do that. Or even if someone's in a wheelchair or has suffered the loss, their children and spouse have died, for example. So I think when this topic comes up is to point out, where are there cases where we say, no, it's better to allow someone to suffer than to let them commit suicide? And then they'll say, well, what are these other cases where someone's really sick and they're dying? Say, okay, but where do you draw the line? There's no way where you can draw the line to say, this is an okay reason for suicide, but this isn't. If the argument is, well, someone is dying and they have 6 months left to live and they have cancer, you might say, well, okay, if you're worried about them suffering for those 6 months, what about someone who has a disease that's not terminal and they'll suffer for 40 or 50 years? Most people who defend assisted suicide would not suggest assisted suicide in those cases. So rather, what's important is to focus on is, do we treat every human being with dignity? And do we treat suicide as something as an attack on their dignity, something we help them out of? And we don't treat some lives as being worth living and other lives are not. If you want to stay on the line, I believe we have a 20 answers booklet on this, end of life choices, I would love to send to you. And then my friend Stephanie Gray Connors wrote a book. It's called Start With What? 10 Principles for Thinking About Assisted Suicide. Start With What by Stephanie Gray Connors, I'd recommend. But if you stay on the line, I'd enjoy sending you copies of 20 Answers End of Life. I think Jason Negri wrote it. Very good booklet, I would definitely recommend. So thank you for calling in.
Hang on, Jen. We'll get you that book if you just give us an address to send it to. Trent Horn is our guest. His podcast is The Council of Trent. And just spell council the one way, not the other way. And you've got it, Council of Trent. You can find it at TrentHornPodcast.com.
I want to apologize, by the way, for making you hungry before when I talked about the cafeteria.
It was the dark chocolate covered
The cashews?
Cashews. Yeah, that was killing me, dude. That was killing me.
It's funny. I got to visit Google headquarters once. Yeah. And the thing that I was blown away by was you go in and they have like the free buffet. It's just free for, I don't know if they still have it, but it was just the free buffet for employees and it's just anything you want. And my wife and I visited, my wife blurted out, she's like, why doesn't everyone here weigh like 200 pounds? Like,
I'm with
300 pounds.
I'm with Laura on that one. Yeah.
Just dashing towards it. But no, everyone there, like, they just get their little tiny bowl and they eat. I'm like, and it's free. And I'm like, you're not working the system enough, people.
There's not enough peer pressure. Not enough peer pressure in the world to keep me away from the free Google food, even though I've never been there. Check out Trent Horn's podcast at TrentHornPodcast.com. You got anything good coming up, Trent? Anything good coming up?
Oh, yeah. We got some great Free For All Friday content and some very good content critiquing all different sorts of people next week. Definitely stay tuned for that.
All right. Well, if you got a science question, if it's a faith and science question, you can go ahead and stay on the line. But the next hour, Dr. Stacey Trusenko, scientist and theologian, is coming in. And she's really good at the faith and science stuff. So if you've got something you want to ask about a scientific theory, about how faith and science are compatible or not compatible, whatever it is, give a call. 888-318-7884. And we will take a very quick break and be right back. Thanks, Trent.
Thank you, sir.
Right back.